New York Times used to be called the Gray Lady of Journalism, but it's trying harder than ever to shed that image. Increasing the diversity of columnists and other opinion makers. One example is Jane Costin. She's the new host of the paper's podcast called The Argument. She is biracial. She is a proud libertarian. I talked to her about race and politics and cancel culture. It was while the George Floyd trial was still underway, and the conversation took place after I thanked her for being on my podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You describe yourself as a registered libertarian. I don't think the listeners to my program have heard from a lot of registered libertarians, certainly not as program hosts being sponsored by the New York Times. What does it mean to be a registered libertarian as far as you're concerned?
Well, in the micro level, it means that I am a registered member of the Libertarian Party. If you look up my election record, it says that I am a registered libertarian. It does not tell you who for whom I have voted, but it does tell you that. And I think that for me, it's interesting because one of the funny things about the libertarian movement or the Libertarian Party is the challenge that libertarians face is that many people really like libertarian-leaning ideas, particularly when it has to do with something that's important to them. So, for example, if you are concerned with the state having a lot of power over your life, you have a lot of libertarian leanings when it comes to you. I've often said that everyone's a personal libertarian. Everyone is kind of like, I should be able to do things, but other people should not be able to do things. And I think that's the problem. And I also think the challenge is I am among many libertarians who, while being members of the Libertarian Party, finds the Libertarian Party kind of... One of the challenges you get is that there is a purity spiral to party politics, as there is in every party. And the Libertarian Party is definitely an example of that, though they have been growing in success as being the country's third... essentially the largest third party, that still means that they are obviously dwarfed by both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And I definitely think that my status as a libertarian has to do with my concerns about the state power, particularly when it has to do with the criminal justice system, which is a massive extension of state power, and also my concerns with how both Republicans and Democrats think of state power, which is very much, well, if it's against us, it's bad, but if it's against them, it's fine. But I have a lot of critiques of the Libertarian Party, but I think that that's kind of the libertarian experience, is you're frequently unhappy and displeased with everything that happens.
Well, if on the one hand you're saying that it's you're a libertarian or you approve of things if they're things that you want to do, but you don't otherwise, there's sort of a contradiction there, it seems to me. How are you comfortable with that? How do you resolve the differences that you outlined?
Well, I think that that's one of the big challenges here, is that I often think in terms of my own politics, okay, I would like this to happen because I would like this to happen, but if this were suggested by the person in politics that I dislike the most, if this were suggested from an administration that I disliked, would I still support it? Do I support something happening that is good for me but bad for someone else? Do I support something happening that if it happened to me, I would be outraged by? Which I think is so much of our conversation about criminal justice reform and the idea of policing. It's not just about race, but also the idea that there are people who should be policed and people who should not be policed. I think we saw one of the things that was most telling during the January 6th attempted takeover of Congress was a police officer who was literally being beaten with a thin blue line flag. Which I think was a markedly telling moment about the idea that there are people who are supposed to be policed and there are people who are not supposed to be policed. And I think that what we saw during some of the anti-lockdown protests last year, even though lockdown is not the right term to be using, is this idea of like, well, we've supported the police, but now they're trying to tell us to do things. And that's not how this works. This idea of policing as quid pro quo. And so much of our politics, you're seeing right now, Republicans getting very mad at corporations because they thought they had a quid pro quo with corporate America, that we will make sure that you will never face taxes. We will never face any hindrances to the extensions of your power. All you have to do is just keep sending us money and not say too much. And now that they believe that that argument or that relationship has been broken. And I think that's one of the challenges here, is that something that benefits me may not benefit other people. And sometimes that's okay. Sometimes that's how politics works. And sometimes something that benefits someone else won't benefit me. And I'm like, okay. But it's important to think about that, those relationships and how all of that intersects. And I think that's something I think about all the time, of because it, you know, if this person gets arrested and I'm like, yay, but they get arrested for something that if I were arrested for, I'd be outraged. Well, that's questionable. Even if it's, sometimes Schadenfreude is a very powerful emotion, but it's not actually true.
It sounds as if being a libertarian has nothing whatsoever to do with being a Republican. You really do see yourself as separate. A lot of people think that they're the same thing.
Oh, absolutely. I think that I've done a lot of writing on this subject, but I think the incorrect conflation of libertarian politics and Republican politics comes because of the relationship the two entities once had under the idea of fusionism. But fusionism was based on, well, we're libertarians and you're Republicans, but we all hate communism. And after the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet system, and this goes to a lot of our politics, if you don't hate the same people, what else do you have in common? And we've seen libertarians having a really interesting and divergent opinions on legalizing sex work or criminal justice reform or thinking about extensions of state power in every aspect of our lives, and Republicans having very different views, particularly up to and including the Trump administration, which very much was like, well, yes, big government is good, but it's us, so it's extra good. And so I think that relationship has been severed, and there are still conservative libertarians who think of themselves as being a Republican, but I think that is more about the clear recognition that if you have bicameral legislatures and two major parties, it's probably best to vote for one of the two main candidates in big elections.
Well, it makes a difference because one or the other of them is going to win. You don't have a lot of libertarians running for president who actually have a chance to win it.
Right. Though, in interesting news, both in 2016 and 2020, we saw Libertarian Party candidates that performed better than the margin. It's particularly in the most recent election, the Libertarian Party candidate outperformed the margin of difference between Joe Biden and Donald Trump in a number of states. So they may not win, but they can provide, like, they can be useful spoilers.
That's interesting. I think a lot of our listeners probably don't know who the Libertarian candidates for president was in either of those years.
Well, in 2016, that was Gary Johnson. And it's interesting because Gary Johnson's campaign was very much based on an interesting idea, which is, I can be simultaneously like Donald Trump in some ways, but like Bernie Sanders in other ways, and like Hillary Clinton in some ways, so I can just make everybody happy. But in 2020, the Libertarian Party presidential candidate, for whom I did not vote, to be clear, was Joe Jorgensen, who was a very libertarian candidate. And it was one of those moments where if you look at her party platform, there were certain elements like on criminal justice reform or drug legalization where I was like, this sounds great. And then others where I was like, that sounds not good. And I think that's the thing about party politics, is that Joe Jorgensen was a terrific representation of what the Libertarian Party looks like in 2020, not necessarily what libertarians look like in 2020.
Do you identify with the idea that a candidate could be like Trump, like Hillary, and like Sanders all at the same time?
No, besides being all members of the same species. I think that was an effort and can be an effort. I mean, so much of our politics, and it's truly fascinating to me because we see all the time particularly in social media platforms or kind of our siloed media, that people purportedly hate centrists, that we hate people who are in the middle, and we want people who are like the, you know, coming out exactly as like this, whatever, to the, you want people on the bleeding edge of whatever it is. But people keep running a centrist because voters actually kind of do like centrists. And I think what Gary Johnson was trying to do was get that, like, you may not think that the Libertarian Party stands for you, but you're actually more libertarian than you think you are. And I think that that's kind of true for many people. But again, it's about that personal libertarianism. It's the idea of, I don't want the state telling me what to do, but I would like the state to tell somebody else what to do.
You have a very interesting history. Tell us a little bit about who you are and how you got that way, who your parents were, who your grandparents were. They're really interesting.
Yeah. So I was born in Cincinnati, Ohio. I went to 13 years of Catholic school in Cincinnati. And my mom, she was a court-appointed special advocate for neglect and abused children through the organization ProKids. And now she works still with neglected and abused children within the juvenile justice and foster care system. My dad is a retired librarian. He's African-American, retired librarian at the Public Library of Cincinnati in Hamilton County. He was a research librarian and a film librarian. So when I was a kid, I've seen a lot of movies, but I never saw like big budget movies. I don't think I saw Jurassic Park until I was in my teens, but I had seen like tiny French movies that nobody's ever heard of, like Diva, which was excellent, by the way. And on my dad's side, my grandparents, my grandmother, who is I think one of my real role models, my late grandmother, she was for one of the first Black people to work in the Pentagon. She desegregated the church that I grew up going to in Cincinnati, St. Anthony's. She had to receive a letter of permission from the Archdiocese to go, and they expected her to sit in the back of the church, and she said absolutely not, and she marched my dad, my uncle, and my aunt up to the front and sat in the front pew, and that's where she sat for the next 50 years. And my grandfather served as in the balloon barrage unit, which was one of the only African-American army unit to land on the beaches of Normandy. And what their job was essentially was to draw enemy fire towards them and away from the beach. And it was terrifying and horrific and very scary. And I unfortunately, he passed away in 1968. But his name was Oscar Costin. And I always use his name because I'm always looking to learn more about him. And it's interesting because I've tweeted about him and had people who are also Costins. One of the funny things is that all Costins are related. If you are a Costin, if your last name is C-O-A-S-T-O-N, you are related to me. And I have found cousins. I have found second cousins. I have found all these people who are like, oh, yeah, like your grandmother is my great aunt or something like that. And so I always like to use their names. But my parents are very liberal. They're kind of union Democrats who have always been liberal. But we were a very liberal family. In a fairly liberal at the time for Cincinnati, area of Cincinnati, in a very conservative state, which is Ohio in the late 1990s and early 2000s, and probably still pretty conservative state comparatively. And so, as I've said before, it was fascinating to be on an ideological island where my parents and my family thought that the people around us were very strange and wrong, and people thought my family was very strange and wrong. And so I've always been interested in knowing why people think and how people think they do, how they do, because everybody gets to their ideological beachhead in a different way. And I've always understood that people do not come to their political leanings because they dislike me personally, in general. Though I think that we have seen kind of a rise of reactionary politics that is very much based on I don't like you personally. But I think that something that's really interesting to me is how people get to their politics and why people get to their politics. And that's something that's really shaped the work that I've done.
Just have to take a couple of facts that I read in the Washington Post that you didn't mention. One is that your grandmother, who you described as such an extraordinary person, able to desegregate that church all by herself, her house was burned down by the Ku Klux Klan when she was a child?
Yep. Her house was burned down by the Klan. She grew up in rural Georgia, and her house was burned down by the Klan, and it would be the early 1930s. And because the Klan was essentially the power structure at the time, there was really nothing that could be done. But her mother told her, don't let this cause you to start hating white people. You know, the hate that could be caused by what you've seen will grow in you like a tree, and it will take root and you will never get it out. And it's very important that that not happen. And I think that that's something that then influenced the rest of her life. It influenced how, you know, I think that, you know, she went from seeing the Klan burn down her family home to having biracial grandchildren whom she loved very deeply, and to having really wonderful relationships through her church with people of all kinds in a way that I don't think she ever really expected. And then for her to meet my spouse, who's from New Zealand, and my grandmother's first question was, where are you from? And my spouse says, New Zealand. And I don't think my grandmother had ever contemplated the idea of a place called New Zealand, but my grandmother, it was so interesting, because you just think about, she was born in the mid 1920s and she passed away in December of 2015. And the things that she saw throughout her life, I just like the astronomical level of change that she witnessed, and she dealt with it with such grace and such dignity. And at no point did her experiences lead her to do anything but to be the better person. And I think that that's something that's always been a great inspiration for me. And it's also something, you know, like my grandfather was served in a segregated unit and landed on the beaches of Normandy. My grandmother helped desegregate the church I grew up in. Like, I can handle whatever it is that's going to happen. I think I'll be fine.
Yeah, that is the kind of background that gives you a lot of confidence, I would think. I'm interested in the ideological island that you grew up in Cincinnati, and you said that you regarded, or your family regarded, other people as strange and wrong. They regarded your family as strange and wrong. How much did that have to do with the fact that your father was black and your mother was white?
I think in some respects, somewhat. But I also think that's one of the things, it is almost impossible to decouple race from class and race from just general appearance in some ways. And I'll explain what I mean. My father was black and my mom was white, obviously, as I've mentioned. But also, my parents are the kind of people who we only watched PBS. And I grew up believing that Ken Burns was among the most famous filmmakers in the history of time. He is awesome, the documentarian. And I learned to read when I was, I taught myself how to read when I was 3. We were a very academic household. I read the New York Times when I was a little kid. My parents read all that. Me and my dad was a librarian. My mom does crosswords for fun. Like, these are people who are very much about my parents are very academic people. And I think in some ways that was something that people observed as being strange, but not strange as in bad, just strange as in different. You know, we grew up in a pretty, the neighborhood I grew up in, Madisonville, which at the time was kind of now it's gentrifying to somewhat, but when I was growing up, it was kind of a working class area. And very much the fact that my parents' house just plastered with books, and my dad spends most of his time watching Formula One races and talking about the Tour de France, that is something that is different from what other people's parents were doing. And I thought other people's parents were doing things that are strange, because when you're a little kid, you think of your experience as the experience. like, I'm sure listeners, when they're little, you know, you go to your first sleepover and you're like, why is your house like this? What's wrong? Like, I remember the first time I had never had boxed macaroni and cheese until I went over to a friend's house and her mom was making it. And I was just like, why, what? How do they get the cheese in the box? I don't understand. And it was just this baffling experience. But I think that was something where, yes, race was involved. And I think my parents' interracial marriage played a part in just the being different. But one, it wasn't that uncommon for people to be in interracial relationships in my neighborhood or even in Ohio, though more so, it is now far more common than it was when I was a little kid, which is tremendous, the rise of mixed race relationships and mixed race kids, which is great. But it was just also just like a cultural difference. But it was a cultural difference, not of like origin, but just of experience. Like, I grew up in a household where I thought that Michael Schumacher, the Formula One and great, was one of the most famous people alive. And my parents didn't, like, I was like, Michael Jordan, he's just some guy. And so I think that was something that that was a difference maker.
The first line in the Washington Post profile of you says, Jane Costin hates the phrase, the black community. Why do you hate the phrase, the black community?
Because I think it implies a level of sameness. And I always joke that there should be, it's mentioned in the profile, and I do always joke about this, that there should just be a black community Zoom call. You know, just get like, whatever, 13 million of us all on one call, just like LeBron and Alan Keyes yelling at each other or something. Because we do not expect, and I think that it's something that people know, but they still do, like the idea of like, oh, he's a leader in the black community. And I'm like, who voted? I did not vote. I didn't sign anything. There was no one emailed me to be like, is this guy a leader in the black community? And I'm like, no, like at our most recent meeting, we didn't decide this. I think that there is, it's interesting to me, the level of intellectual and cultural diversity that we expect among white Americans, but are shocked by when it comes to any other community. Like all of the people after the 2020 election who were stunned that a lot of Latinos in Texas and Florida voted for Trump, which is only confusing if you think that being of Cuban American heritage or being from El Salvador, having Guatemalan heritage are all the same thing. As if like, yeah, these like millions of people who live in Central and South America, yeah, they're all basically kind of the same. And that's not true, as anyone who is alive would know. But I do think that kind of like, we do not think of people as being representatives of the white community. I would never say like, oh, he's a white community leader. Like, that's just not a thing you would do. People are pretty aware that there's a big difference between like white people en masse, but there's this idea like, and it's interesting to me. And like, I understand that is something that comes, especially for African Americans, the immense pressure. And I mean pressure literally as a weight holding people down of segregation, both de facto and de jure segregation, and the legacy of slavery, which did mean that there was a similarity of experience for millions of African Americans in the 20th century. I also think that similarity of experience and that shared trauma of prejudice, I think, doesn't make it that people weren't different. Like African American, my grandma grew up in rural Georgia. And she did not grow up in Harlem during the 1920s and 1930s. She did not grow up in Southern California in the 1920s and 1930s. Her experience was very different. And yet, for many people, just being like, oh, African-American, Great Migration, that's what we got it. I think that dilutes a lot of the experience that millions of Americans have had.
So it's obvious and widely reported that a lot of white people stereotype black people. Does it work both ways around? Do blacks stereotype whites too?
Yeah, I think it gets, I think that becomes an idea that becomes representative when, again, we no one was polled about it. And I think that especially it's like when you're thinking about other forms of hate, there is kind of the individual hate, individual hatred, and then there's hatred that becomes a systemic entity of itself. And I think that also, though, it's important to recognize that it's not as if that hating white people is good or effective or helpful or not evil. But I think that there is also, it's worth noting that for the vast majority of black people who, and I think it's even hard saying this because it's like, I have obviously not polled all black people because for some reason, Oprah Winfrey will not return my calls. But I think that it's worth noting that, like, I am certain that there are some black people who would say things like, I hate all white people. And I am certain that there are many black people who would say, absolutely not. And that's, I think that that is kind of the, one of the challenges here is that for some African Americans, I think white people, that construct has become, it means I hate this superstructure, I hate the criminal justice system, I hate this entity that exists, I believe, purely in opposition to me and mine, to where it, but then I think it's the same thing of like, well, we don't mean these people, and we don't mean these people, and we don't mean these people. I think it becomes a way of making sense of a experience of oppression in a way that doesn't really make much sense.
We're talking with Jane Costin, Libertarian Party member and new host of The Argument, a podcast from the New York Times. We'll be back with her in a moment on To the Point. Well, and I'll be back with To the Point, talking with Jane Costin, the new host of The Argument, a podcast from the New York Times. She herself is racially mixed. She is reportedly frustrated by the phrase black community as an example of stereotyping a diverse group of people because of their skin color. So I asked her this, what did she think of the term white privilege? I told her I come from a white family, and even though my father created the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice back in the 1950s, I still feel sort of guilty as the beneficiary of white privilege.
Well, I think that one of the challenges that we have is that words matter and words are important. But I think privilege, I'm reminded there was a piece in National Review a couple of years ago. And I think, interestingly, I believe it was written by J.D. Vance, where it talked about, you know, if you talk to someone in rural West Virginia, which is actually, my mom is from St. Mary's, West Virginia. And if you talk to someone who has witnessed the collapse of their town because of the loss of the coal industry and because of the opioid crisis, and you tell them that they are privileged, they'll be like, we have no idea what you're talking about. So I think privilege is perhaps not the right word to use, especially because it becomes a cudgel term. But I think that perhaps the way I think about it is the difference and these group expectations and what expectations one can have when one is from different racial groups. And I'll give you an example. I wrote a piece a couple of years ago, and I think about it a lot because part of our issue, I think, with policing is simultaneous over-policing and under-policing. And it's important that people recognize that there are a lot of laws in this country at the local, state, and federal level. And a lot of those laws aren't enforced all the time or ever unless they are. And for instance, I wrote about an example in Florida in which a man, thank God he was on video, he was arrested for jaywalking and for walking without an ID. Neither of those are crimes in Florida. I checked. They are not, like, you cannot arrest someone for walking without identification. But I think that that goes to so much of our experience, which is that it is not necessarily, It is that there are people who do get arrested for things, and there are people who don't get arrested for things. And the people who do get arrested for things tend to look one way, and the people who don't get arrested for things tend to look another way. Now, the result is not like, oh, everyone should get arrested for everything, but it is that this, the idea of privilege or expectation or allowance, I think indicates that there are a group of people who, based on race in a lot of cases, are allowed to do certain things that other people are not allowed to do. And you can think about it in your everyday life. If you've ever made an illegal left-hand turn, if you've ever said, oh no, I forgot something at home, and you pull the U-turn in the middle of a road where you're not really supposed to do that, and nothing happened to you. Or if you had a really, if you were in college and you had a really raucous party, and the cops came, but they just talked to someone at your house and were like, can you just keep it down, guys? There is a difference of experience where how that wound up for you and how that wound up for someone who doesn't look like you might be two very different things. And I think that so much the answer becomes, for some people, is like, well, we should just enforce all of these laws equally. But I think that that's a bit of a fallacy in itself, because a lot of these laws, a lot of these regulations, maybe if we can't enforce them equally, if we aren't doing so, maybe that's an indication that we don't necessarily need them, or we need to reduce the number of them. But I think privilege implies something like, ah, yes, you are privileged. You are allowed to go do this amazing thing. But it's not about that. It is about the fact that there is a clear understanding, and we all know it. We know that there is a group of people for whom, even if they are not experiencing any benefit of their race, any benefit of being white, any benefit of like having more money or living in a nicer place, they are not experiencing the detriment based on their race. They may be living in an area that is underserved. They may be living in an area that has been hollowed out by the opioid crisis, and then doubly hollowed out by the response to the opioid crisis. But they are not then suffering the deleterious effects that would be added on if they were also African American, or in many cases, Latino. And I think that that's how I think about this, that it is not a pass to do anything. It is an added burden. And I think that that's something that I've always felt, where I remember being a freshman in high school. I was taking English 2 honors. And my teacher told me, you know, you're going to have to work twice as hard because you're black. And I was like, what? Like, that's ridiculous. Because I think that you have this idea that, like, I'm black, but I don't, you think people might see you as you see you, as just being like, I am just a normal everyday person who thinks a lot about football. But I'm aware that that's not how other people see me. And I'm aware that I do have this added burden. Now, how that burden is interpreted, that's up for other people to do. But I am aware that I have this added burden, that I need to be better, and I need to be smarter, and I need to sound more intelligent, and I need to sound more eloquent. And even if I do those things, my intelligence or my eloquence will come into what is she intelligent or eloquent for being non-white? Or is she like, what, you are treated as part of an amalgamous mass where white people are permitted a level of individuality. And I think that it's challenging because it gets the micro experience of this, which is mine, and the macro experience of this, which is the millions of people in this country. It's hard to not conflate the two. I'm aware that having my English two honors, English one honors, one of the two.
Was that teacher white or black?
White.
Okay.
Very elderly and white. Very nice. But I'm aware that that is not the biggest issue in the history of time. And I think that a lot of times we are taking the experiences of people like me who have experienced, you know, I went to a private all-girls high school because I got a scholarship, but like I went to a private all-girls high school. I was not like, what my grandparents went through was not my experience. And I think that we have put too much emphasis on experiences like mine and not enough emphasis on the class plus race discrimination that so many people living in poverty who are also African-American and not experience. Like, I think that so much of what we see when people are talking about race is like, well, if we have more non-white people on the board of this big corporation, that'll be helpful. And I'm like, no, that's not helpful. But I do think that that experience of recognizing that at no point there will always be someone who believes that I have gotten my job because I am an affirmative action hire, as they email me about, or that I have done something or been something that is not representative of my race or too representative of my race or something having to do with my race. That is something that I will likely always experience. And I think that that is not a call for action, but it is a call for people to think about it. And I think that that's something, the use of the word privilege, I think, is not the right one, but it is this idea of like this thing you don't have to think about, this weight you don't carry.
Thank you very much. That's a really interesting way of putting it. I'm interested in this. This kind of argument that you've been making about the burden that African-American people particularly have, but are people of color or however you want to describe it, has been talked a lot about lately, particularly, of course, in the context of what's happening with police behavior, which you mentioned earlier. You're very concerned and interested in criminal justice. And it seems to me that it's been possible to talk about that in ways that haven't been before, in part because there are videos and we have this technology now and you can actually see it happening. And there was the Army lieutenant who refused to get out of his car and had the presence of mind to put the phone on the dashboard so you could see what happened when he had his hands in the air, fearful apparently of putting them down to undo his seatbelt because somebody would think he was reaching for a gun. And you could see him, there he was, getting squirted in the face directly with pepper spray. That's a pretty important lesson, it seems to me, for everybody.
Right. And especially because I've seen it mentioned, people asking like, well, why didn't he pull over right away? And I think it's important to note that he well knew what could happen if he got pulled over in a dark, desolate area by himself. And it's the thing that we're all thinking. And what I found interesting, and I think that that goes to my point earlier about personal libertarianism, is that you saw a bunch of people responding to it like, why didn't he just comply? Why didn't he just comply? Why didn't he just comply? And I keep thinking that a lot of these are the same people who were absolutely outraged at police who enforce mask mandates or police who arrested people following the January 6th brouhaha. And the idea of the police should police this guy, the police should throw the book at this person, but not at me or people like me, because I, you know, I don't have to comply. They have to comply. I think that that's really important here. And especially because this is someone who's a member of the military and in uniform. And yet that means nothing. That means absolutely nothing. And it's, I don't know. I think that the use of video evidence is very helpful, but it is interesting to see the way that people will watch these videos and then find literally any reason to interpret them in the way that they find most beneficial to their own point of view. You think that there's like a video that would prove something, but it turns out that nothing truly can be proven if you don't want it to be.
You have talked a lot about cancel culture, and I know you've done a program about it. I'm just curious about your take on it, because it is so much in the news today, and it's so confusing to a lot of people. What is it, do you think? What is cancel culture, and what's good or bad about it?
I think it is intentionally confusing, and I'll tell you why. I am interested, one, the idea of something being canceled is actually something that kind of came from, like, black internet culture of, like, So the idea being that, like, this person said something incredibly stupid and you're like, she's canceled. That's ridiculous. But I think that something that is also important to recognize is that the cancel culture conceit can be very financially helpful. If you can say that people don't want to hear what I have to say, or people want to keep what I have to say from you, that is a very sexy way to promote something. Even if what you're promoting is stupid. And, you know, you can think about any number of provocateurs of the last 10 to 15 years, or even going back to someone like Andrew Dice Clay, where part of the entire point is, like, we used to call this political correctness. The entire idea of, like, well, he's being anti-PC or something, when it's just, like, just saying offensive things about women. But I think that the challenge here is that we are also in the midst of an internet culture. That means that there's a long-running joke about Twitter, which is that every day on Twitter, the goal is to not be it. And no one, you know, and by it, it's, like, the main story on Twitter. And some of these examples aren't of famous people. They aren't of people who have really done anything. It's that you were on video doing something stupid or racist or misogynistic or homophobic or transphobic or something. And you are not a public figure. And yet your actions have made you a public figure, an infamous figure. And it's not even a long running public figure dumb. Like, you can be trending on Twitter on Tuesday and no one forgets who you are by Friday. But in those several days, your life has changed irreparably. And I think that that's something I think about a lot, about, like, you know, you hear members of Congress claiming to be canceled, or people saying that Donald Trump was canceled or something like that. I'm like, no, he's not. Clearly not. That's the use of this term as a political cudgel. But I do think that for the anonymous people who lose their jobs because of a bad tweet, people who are not well known, people who have something that they said 20 years ago when they were 12 brought up against them and used against them in order to get them removed from a job. I think that that's deeply concerning, but that's also, I think that it's worth noting that the concept of shaming, I mean, I had to read the Scarlet Letter in high school, as did most people, I believe, have to read the Scarlet Letter in high school. This isn't new. This is not a new impulse. The idea of wanting to shame people who have done something wrong in a morality that is defined by you or your culture is not new. But I do think that the role of the internet playing in it, in which it's like, how do I know about this person? How do I know about this person who is living in Seattle who did something on video? It's because of social media. And I think that the role that that plays is new. But I also think it's important to recognize that there is a financial impulse to this, where part of it is people using this term in order to create a separation between themselves and what they said. And by that I mean, you know, if someone says something racist, let's say, and then they say that people are trying to cancel them for it, then they can focus, people will focus on that, like, oh, is he being canceled? Is he not being canceled? And no one actually asks, wait, what did he say? Or what did he do? And I think that that's why it's worth focusing on the actions people have taken, on what did someone say? What did they actually do? Not getting into a, were they canceled? Were they not canceled? Which is a back and forth that gets so boring that I desperately hope most listeners have not paid attention to it, because I think that that turns into kind of a media argument and a meta argument. But it's the world of social media. It's the world of a concept of shame that is not new, but can be weaponized in a way that it perhaps was not before. And I think that that's something, and especially when it is happening to anonymous people, I think that, like, if you're a very famous actress or actor, if you're an extremely famous cable television host, you're probably not being canceled. You're just getting yelled at a lot on the internet. And I think that being able to deal with being yelled at a lot on the internet is important to do if you're a public figure, because the benefits of being a public figure can be pretty awesome in a lot of respects. But I do think that for people who are not public figures, there is, I think that that's very different to me.
I won't go into a lot of public, a lot of examples about public figures involved because we just simply don't have any time to do it. Although I really understand very well, I think, the arguments that you're making. And speaking of the argument, that's the name of your podcast, and it's new, and it is produced by the New York Times. And you have said that your objective is with the argument not to have people going back and forth necessarily and shouting at each other, but rather to bring an openness to being persuaded. What do you mean by that?
I think that so much of our political cultural discussions are about position fights of two ideas, and you just yell them at each other while indicating where your position is and how that's better than where the other person's position is. I don't want people to do that. I've been wrong before. There are things I think very deeply that I am completely willing to admit I could be wrong about. I don't know. It's okay to not know. And it's okay to have your mind change. And I think that that's something that we've been able to do. You know, we did an episode on student loan forgiveness, and I had a lot of people emailing me like, I really thought I would be on the side of the person arguing against total student loan forgiveness, and now I'm in favor of it. And I heard a lot of people saying vice versa. And I think that the willingness to change your mind doesn't mean that you are weak or that you didn't think hard enough about these things. It just means that something, you receive new information, which is good. And I think that that's something that is really lacking, in which you have people who exist as their positions. And a lot of that happens on the internet, where the social media is so flattening of who you are that you become your political positions, when that's not how most people work. But I think people being willing to change and willing to either have their minds changed, but also willing to not. There are sometimes where people listen to episodes, they're like, actually, I just confirm everything that I already think. And I think that that's great. And so I'm interested in that. I'm not trying to change people's minds necessarily, but I am asking people to be open to new information, to new ideas, and to, if that does change your mind, well, that's cool too.
Do you specifically look for guests that wouldn't necessarily be cited in articles in the New York Times?
I think we do. I think that it's interesting because we were just actually having a conversation about, are we thinking about ideas or thinking about guests? And I do. I look for people who I think are having interesting conversations. I look for people who are holding interesting positions, especially people who are willing to kind of talk about those positions or battle over those positions. And I look for people who are trying to have a conversation, and I try to find the right conversation partner to have about their ideas.
Well, it's been very interesting to talk to you and get your ideas. It's interesting to know that the argument isn't necessarily one that you want to press or push on anybody, but rather something quite different from that. Once again, the podcast is called The Argument. Jane Costin is the host. I don't know how many you've done yet, not very many as so far, but it's already getting to have a lot of conversation, a lot of talk about it, and we're just delighted to have you on our program, and thanks a lot for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now listen to this. You can check the To The Point feed for a special project, a 6-podcast series, new episode running every week, called In Our Backyard. It's based on this premise that climate change is already here in Southern California. Consider the wildfires, the sea level rise, the drought. And while we can't prevent it, we can prevent it from getting worse than it needs to be. You'll hear an inspiring cast of characters, from a surfer on a beach with no sand to a young woman who evacuated from her first wildfire at the age of 8. Again, it's In Our Backyard. It's on the To The Point feed. I want to know what you think. The producer of To The Point is Andrea Brody. Our engineer's Chuck Prevetary. You can listen again to this episode and others available on your favorite podcasting app. On Twitter, we're at @ToThePoint_KCRW. You can get me directly at WarrenAlney1. Or you can email me directly at warrenalney@kcrw.org. Please do it. I really want to know what you think. Thanks for listening this time. Join us again. Don't forget that climate series.